Welcome to People's Pensions, the podcast that discusses how to improve pension provision for savers across the UK.
The triple lock is the government's policy.
We've attacked our pension funds.
Because pension credit can make a huge difference.
Each episode, Phil Brown will be joined by experts from inside and outside the industry to look at some of the big issues in pensions and discuss how to ensure people have enough to live on once they finish working.
We make sure that money goes into the account.
They have over 5 million members.
I want to be comfortable when I get old.
One of the side effects of automatic enrolment has been the creation of millions of small deferred pension pots scattered across the pensions landscape. With the average person working more than 10 jobs in a lifetime, this problem is only going to get bigger, much bigger. In the recent Mansion House reforms, the government asked for responses on its initial plan. It's opted for the multiple consolidators model, where small pots could be automatically transferred into large approved schemes. The government plans to set up a delivery group by the end of the year. So how might all this work? And is it good news for savers? Here's Phil Brown with his panel of experts.
Good afternoon and welcome to our podcast. And today I'd like to welcome Zoe Alexander, Director of Strategy and Corporate Affairs at Nest, Lizzie Holliday, Director of Public Affairs and Policy at Now, Ian Digby, Director of Policy and Regulation at Smart Pension, and finally, Sarah Luheshi, Deputy Director, Pensions Policy Institute, all of whom are experts in this field, as in pensions and policy. So I'd like to welcome you all. Thank you for joining me. I guess to kick this off, it's worth saying that the small pots paper and the issue of consolidation within that paper dovetails into the wider Mansion House changes because it's about building scale and it's about using that scale to invest in things like illiquid assets. And it's about thinking about all of those issues in aggregate rather than in isolation, which might be how we were looking at them a couple of years ago. So looking at them in aggregate. So I'd like to applaud Laura Trott for actually putting these papers together with her teams and actually showing how they fit together in a way that previous policy hasn't. And to start with, Sarah, I wonder if you could give us a view on whether the consolidation agenda is likely to lead to a resolution in the small pot issue based on the international research evidence that you did a little while ago?
Yeah, sure. The research was taken from 2020-2021 and we looked at a number of countries. And I think it's fair to say that, yes, in the main, it has led to a reduction in the number of small pots. So if you take Australia, for example, they have a number of different elements to their strategy here. They have reduced the number. They haven't eliminated all small pots. And I'll just explain. So in Australia, there's something like 6 million accounts held by 4.4 million people. And the reason is that Australians are given an active choice as to what they do. And some have actively chosen to keep multiple pots. So it's difficult to say it will reduce it down to zero if we're going to give people an element of choice as to how they might want to handle it. And what we're not going to stop is those who want to hold multiple accounts, but hopefully the balance on such accounts might be a bit higher.
Thank you. That's really useful as an opener. I think part of the issue here relates to how you read things like value for money across into consolidation and how value for money will be used in the authorisation regime, which we don't know a lot about yet. So, Lizzie, do you see consolidation as a route to providing better quality pension provision, not just bigger pension schemes?
All of these questions are quite challenging, aren't they? Because I think we probably don't have the level of detail that we might have hoped for in the consultations. So trying to work out exactly how we see this all happening, I think, is a little bit of a challenge. But I guess in terms of increasing or getting better quality, I guess you're looking for a number of ingredients, and those include competition and innovation as well as regulation. I think what the multiple default consolidator does with the proposal around the authorisation process, but equally yet to see the detail of what that includes, you would expect it to drive better quality, depending how you define quality. I think what it does do is it provides reassurance that if you've got lots of small pots moving around the system, and that's happening on a default or an automated process, however that's defined, what you do want to make sure is that you know that the destination, if you're a trustee, you want to know that the destination of where your member's pot is going to be to a good quality scheme. So I think at the lower level, what you've got is an assurance about the floor, an assurance about the quality of the scheme that the pot will be going to. I think obviously there's a balance to be had in terms of the number of consolidators, what that means for the Mansion House policy agenda, what that means for innovation and competition. And I think they're all questions that are up for grabs at the moment. And I think they are things that will become clearer as we get more details on the process.
And one of the things I've also observed in this, in looking at the paper that is specifically about value for money, is I'm not sure if innovative is the right word, but actually giving regulators powers to intervene in schemes is never been done before. There's two of us sat here, in myself and Ian, who've both been kind of regulators, albeit in different regulators. But Ian, did that surprise you when you saw that?
No, I didn't see it coming. But I see with the government as they currently stand at the minute, it seems to be a natural progression of what the government is trying to achieve at this point in time. Having said that, though, I think it will create some challenges for regulators and also for the industry in particular, and particularly if other initiatives within not only VFM, but regarding the small pots consolidation agenda proceed, is going to create a greater burden for those regulators to be able to intervene and achieve that objective.
Zoe, would you like to come in on that?
Yeah, I mean, I just think the value for money piece is really critical to this picture, isn't it? Because if you have a small number of default consolidators, setting that value for money bar at the right level and making sure that trustees, as Lizzie said, have assurance that when pots are being automatically consolidated, they're going to a really high quality scheme is absolutely critical. So the authorisation regime for those consolidators is critical. But if you get that right, I think it's absolutely the right solution. I think it's one of the reasons that, unless we have concerns about the idea of pot follows member, because in that case, you don't have assurance always that people are going to be moving to schemes that pass that high bar. And similarly with stapling, you don't have assurance because I don't think the market is mature enough to handle those kinds of dynamics. And so I think there is a world in which this all comes together incredibly neatly across the value for money agenda, across the productive finance agenda, and across the small pots agenda to work really well in the interest of members.
That's really useful. Thank you. It's actually a really good segue because you used the word stapling. But before we kind of get into that, Lizzie, did you want to come in on that?
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, I totally agree with that kind of assessment of the situation. I think the interesting thing will be, and the critical thing will be, is not to have overlapping policy solutions. So where is the emphasis going to be in terms of the authorisation criteria? If you've got a kind of the super duper value for money framework, what additional requirements on top of that will be part of the consolidated regime? And I think that's where the knitting together of the policy areas becomes quite critical, so that you don't get two policy solutions all aiming at or duplicating a solution. So I think it would be quite interesting, to say the least, going forward to look at what in addition can be added to that authorisation criteria, or does that make a difference to what's in the value for money framework? I think looking at the solutions across the piece, as well as the issues or the ambitions, I think it's the detail of the solutions that becomes critical.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, that generates a whole plethora of other thought, right? So if you have authorized consolidators and as Zoe pointed out, a limited number, because that's how the consultation's framed, do you get to a position where those consolidators have to have products with similar characteristics so people can move between them without any form of detriment or harm? So there's some really interesting unanswered questions that I look forward to seeing kind of how they respond to. Sarah.
Yeah, I was just going to come in because I think it's one of the things that member exchange does appear in the whole of the consultation. And one of the concerns is moving people without them necessarily knowing about it. And one of the risks that we've got to consider, we work in an incredibly long-term industry. If we start moving people who don't know that they're being moved, and then something happens within that scheme and it's to their huge detriment. Are we, how do we actually manage the risk? How do we address a risk if that happens? And so I think some of these things are, I think I go with Lizzie on this, the devil's in the detail at times, and we need to be very mindful as to how some of this is actually legislated and regulated for.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say consumer protection has to be at the heart of how absolutely. Consolidation works. And hence me asking that question of whether there should be similar characteristics between products of different providers.
I think the similarity, but not necessarily identical, because you still need to have an element of competition within the market. And I suppose as the neutral observer to this, I'm not sitting in a provider, having a limited number of consolidators just raises the question in my mind as to how does that encourage competition? How might we encourage new entrants or new people wanting to come into the market? And I just, whether this is a level of intervention, and how do we actually address it?
Yeah, that, I mean, that's a really important question, because until we actually see what an authorization regime looks like, we can't answer that. How do you get a new entrant into the market? If somebody wants to get authorization to be a master trust, or wants FCA authorization to run a pension product, you know the route to do that. We don't know the route to do the consolidation thing yet. So that's a really important question. If I pull us back round to that word Zoe used, stapling, the consultation refers to a kind of a long-term goal of stapling people to active pots. And there's a question that generates about how realistic is it to staple people to the active pot they're in at the moment, and what sort of administration effort would be required to get there? I mean, they've used this in Australia, and what can we learn from the way they've done it? Ian, do you want to open up on that one?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think it's an interesting concept, and I think from a member's perspective, it provides greater simplicity in some ways, albeit that we know that in the way that automatic enrolments worked in the UK, having an employer in the background, an employee generally tends to have greater certainty and assurance in getting information from their employer rather than from a pension provider themselves. And I know we've all faced challenges around getting members engaged with their pension products. So as I say, it creates greater simplicity for the member, but for the employer, it potentially creates increased complexity. And I think it also creates increased complexity for regulators as well. So I think it potentially would see an upheaval and a re-engineering of the automatic enrolment system, because employers are going to have to be able to identify where the money is to go to for ongoing contributions as part of that journey. I think you also then have challenges potentially for the regulators in being able to identify whether or not those employers are actually fulfilling their duties. I think it also introduces a different dynamic around, and again, I'm going to use the term VFM here, because of the fact that I think as soon as you start stapling or potentially moving into that pot for life model, then you've got to get others that are going to want to come into the market who may not necessarily be operating on the same playing field as we currently find within the master trust space or the general workplace pension space. So whilst they may or may not currently be able to be used apply to become consolidators in the market at some point in the future, if you have stapling and effectively that pot for life for the member, I believe you're going to end up in a situation where you may have providers that need to raise their game really to be able to play accordingly.
Thank you, and I think it's worth saying that there are other jurisdictions that have faced these challenges. So in Australia, that concept of stapling came a period of time after they'd built effectively pipework behind all pensions, where one scheme can collect contributions and actually deliver them to another scheme. And actually that came well before stapling. So there's some interesting dynamics and sequencing that needs thinking about here. And in America, they built a centralized hub, and that has a federated model to push money around between providers. Sarah, can I bring you on that international experience that you've worked on?
Yeah, exactly, because we found that there were three core elements that were required in any system to facilitate consolidation, one of which we do not have in the UK, which is a unique identification number for an individual. The second, you've just touched upon, is a central clearinghouse. And the third, which potentially dashboards when they come in will help, is having unified data standards. So they're the three elements, and you're spot on. The central clearinghouse is an absolute necessity to get this to work.
And they do refer to that in their consultation document. Lizzie?
I guess there's also that kind of age-old question of which problem are we trying to solve here? So where we've been looking at the small pots that are creating challenges for schemes and for members, that's kind of at the lower end of the market, lower end of saving. It's about where the pots are deferred. And I guess in my head, the lifetime provider model is more about the structure of the market. And it's more about solving a different sort of problem. It could also sweep up the small pots problem, but it's kind of aiming at something else. And I think there's sort of a bit of a challenge in trying to tackle too many problems in one go when they're all aiming at slightly different things, because I think the sort of the churn or the challenge that creates for the market structures, I think, is far more significant than the consolidator model. So it's almost like needing to take a step at a time. So you might have your own vision of where you're trying to get to. You might want to introduce things that aren't going to get in the way or that pave the way. But at every step, you need to be reviewing, and where is value for members at the moment? What is the market looking like? What's competition looking like? What are charges looking like? Have we got to where we need to get to for what the member needs out at the end before making huge systemic changes that could have other impacts, like increased marketing costs and more barriers to entry to the market, and might not take account of where we've got to in resolving the small pots problem? So I kind of, on the one hand, want to kind of say, yes, we need to join all the dots up, but it's, on the other hand, you can't really in this area kind of look at where you want to be in 20 years time and put all the steps in place, because so many other things happen along the way. So many other sort of ambitions or policy decisions get made. So I would just kind of, I guess I would just sort of have a tone of caution and think about, instead, what can we learn about stapling to feed into the process of how the consolidator and allocation of consolidators would work, rather than tying in an individual to one scheme forever at this stage.
I think to be fair, they have put it in as a longer term aim. Can I bring you in quickly, Zoe?
Yeah, no, I mean, I entirely agree with that. And I was going to say, I think, you know, the issues that we're dealing with, when you think in administrative terms about what's going on, potentially we've got the dashboard coming in, we've got DigiRAS, so the digitization of relief at source tax relief coming in, we've also got potentially small pot consolidation coming in, and all of those three things have common needs and common issues that need resolving. I think it's really important that, as far as possible, government look across those three issues and the demands being made on schemes and think about both capacity and timing, but also think about what kinds of identification schemes trustees are going to need in order to both show money on the dashboard and, more significantly, move money and give tax relief. Because at the moment we have, you know, real concerns about some of the issues around NINO matching, which I'm not going to get into because it's too technical, but there is a real need to look across those three projects and find some coherence and work with schemes to understand the challenges they're facing. And I think, given that, I think that just gives weight to what Lizzie is saying, which is, let's do this first. Let's get the large consolidators happening. Let's get the dashboard happening. And I think we're, as I said earlier, we don't have a mature enough market, I don't think, for stapling or for portfolios member or for lifetime provider as it stands, because the value just isn't consistent enough across the market. But I do think, as we move through the process of delivering the things that are currently on the table, value will continue to build, because we'll get more consolidation, we'll get the value for money regulations coming in, and then let's look at the market in, say, 5 years' time and see what we think about that kind of top layer of the of kind of member choice or lifetime provider or stapling at that point.
Thank you. Sarah?
I was just going to build on some of Liz's comments, in fact, and just point out that Australia doesn't just have a default consolidator. It actually has multiple policies in place, which probably pick up different elements, some of which is picking up the small pot, some of which is picking up not creating more small pots. And so they have multiple approaches. And in fact, in our international research, which didn't cover all the countries of the world, but covered about nine, no one or country had default consolidation as a standalone. It always had it as something else. Dashboards were often a complementary factor. So Zoe, to your point, it helps people identify if they've got multiple pots and they can then manage it. And the pot follows member is often tied into some of this. So not wishing to be the harbinger of doom, this isn't going to be the only policy change that we're probably going to see in this space. But I think it's about managing the implementation so that we actually see the results of what we're doing and work out what the problem is, Lizzie, to your point, that we're trying to solve.
Yeah, and I think it goes without saying that stopping the proliferation of small pots may not necessarily be the same as dealing with the existing stock of small pots. I think that's a really important point. We've touched on administration a couple of times, and I think it's worth kind of thinking about what sort of administration issues get thrown up by the consolidator proposals, and whether those issues are materially different between the different models that are available. So we've already mentioned pot follows member. So is there a significant material difference between a consolidator model and a pot follows member model when you get down to kind of the base process level? So if I could bring you in on that.
Yeah, sure. So I think fundamentally, providers are going to need to find a pot and push money out to a new scheme. And that's common to both models. So I think in any event, you're going to need some sort of clearinghouse facility. What I'm quite interested in is the cost of those transfers in relation to the small pot consolidation model. And I think, well, I know we did a joint report, didn't we, between People's Now, Smart and Nest a couple of years ago, which showed that money and data transfer costs could be brought down to pence. So that's really cheap potentially, but admin costs of transfers are still relatively high. And I think we need to think carefully and quite quickly about how we can bring those admin costs down as low as possible for bulk transfers without consent in the small pot model that government's describing, and then think about what that means for members. Because obviously, if you've got a very small micro pot, you need to ask yourself whether it's worth moving it if the cost of transfer exceeds the value of the pot. So I think that's something that the consultation doesn't touch on, but does need some quick and focused work to think about, probably involving providers and their scheme administrators.
And I guess that goes into the same category as something we've touched on a few times today. The issue that we actually have is the detail that's needed behind some of this. Detailed thinking, detailed modelling, and what the actual final policy might end up looking like, because we're still at the proposal stage here. By way of finishing, is there, you know, what's the one thing that's really missing to make a kind of a properly informed choice about whether this is the right or wrong thing here? And I'm happy for you to touch that into any of the consultations. It doesn't have to be purely small pots, VFM, any of them. If I could start with you, Zoe.
Yeah, sure. I mean, like, there's a couple of options. So I think the default consolidator model is the right model. There's a couple of options in the consultation about how money should move, and I feel really clearly that within those two options, the preferable one is that it should move to the largest deferred pot, rather than should be moved based on the market share of the consolidators who are authorised. I think from a member experience perspective, that's absolutely critical. And I also think the government should think about, where there's an active pot, moving the money to the active pot so that it feels as seamless as possible to the member. So that's the kind of key point that we want to make in our consultation response and want to make sure lands with government.
Sarah?
Underlying all of this, we are dealing with a number of people who have been invested in pensions for the first time as a result of the phenomenal success of automatic enrolment. My fear and my checkpoint with all of this is, how does all of these, any of these options actually work with reinforcing the success of automatic enrolment and not undermining it? And I know that it's sometimes quite a difficult ask, but actually talking to the individual members and getting their feedback as to what's happening to them, I hope is being considered, if not already done. But I think that's, for me, what part of the missing link here. I know we're basing a lot of AE on inertia, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be led by what members think they might want, even if we don't necessarily adhere to it exactly.
And in a world where things like consumer duty apply, I know they're not directly related to all of us as TPR regulated firms, but you can see where that you know, experience of the member, research before the product is built, where all of that stuff becomes critical in a process. Ian?
I think where I come from is more around what happens if people don't have an active pot, or they end up having a larger pot of money with an organisation which doesn't become a default consolidator, because I think that opens some questions for how the members will then be sort of distributed to a provider at that point. I think the other thing that, and I go back to the point I made earlier, really, around how generally members tend to trust their employer more than they do a pension scheme provider, and how, even in my own case, I look back at historic pensions I have and think, who did I work for at that time? And some of that connection will start to weaken as you go into the default consolidator mode potentially. Now obviously dashboard will help us along the way once it's delivered, and I welcome that sort of moving forward sooner than later, but I think that's going to be one of the key challenges for that part of the population.
I think some of the data standards that come out of dashboards might very well be reutilized here. So actually, we need to get to a place where we have common data standards that can be used in different places for different purposes, but the same sort of standards underpin them.
Lizzie, can I help us?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Lizzie, could I bring you in on that?
I've probably said this before, so apologies if I'm being repetitive, but I feel it quite strongly is the detail that we need around how much of this stuff will work. So to Zoe's point about how will the allocation work, but also to an element of what Ian was saying there about the relationship between the employer, the employee and the scheme. I mean, occupational pensions has grown out of the relationship that works in a certain way. Obviously, things need to evolve, they need to move on. But to Sarah's point about the kind of learning lessons from inertia, the process for auto consolidation does need to use a little bit of inertia. I think we need to think very carefully about where we're trying to rely on engagement. Choice is necessary, don't get me wrong, but I think where choice occurs in that process. And I think the bonds of the relationship, I think under the consolidator, the strength of the relationship is with that longer term relationship with a consolidator scheme that the member can have when they've been popping around different employers. And I think that's really valuable. But I think the provider for life model starts to eat into that relationship and that dynamic, that triangle in the trust-based space between trustee, employer and employee, that I think really needs to be thought about quite hard before that's broken by a lifetime provider model. And I guess more generally, just, you know, that how these things work together. I take the point about the Mansion House policy driving the agenda. I guess my question is that the right driver? I can see why it's the driver. I guess it's just the focus on what the pension is there to deliver is people's savings. And yeah, joining those two things up, I think, is a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, interestingly, we've got some work that we've done in terms of research with members. It's unpublished at the moment, but it actually tests that kind of area around, do you want to make an active choice if you've got a small pot being moved or a deferred pot being moved, or do you want it to be done for you? And at a high level, people just wanted it done. They didn't want to have to make an active choice as to where to move it. They wanted a process that kind of did that for them. And interestingly, with auto enrollment schemes, these are my words. They're not the exact words the members used, but they implied that they trusted an auto enrollment scheme to make the right choice for them, which I found fascinating, given that it was inertia that put them into the scheme in the first place. But that's just something we're working through at the moment. That's been really helpful and a really good discussion. So I'd like to thank you all for joining me today, and if you're up for it, when they publish the final kind of outcome, it might be interesting to kind of rehave this discussion. But I say that slightly guarded because we don't know what that outcome will be yet. So I might regret saying that at a later date. But thank you all for joining me today. That was a really useful discussion.
That was People's Pensions with Phil Brown. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe on your preferred platform or through the People's Pension website, to make sure you never miss an episode.